and activities does not, upon leaving the body, take its birth again in the material world, but attains my eternal abode, O Arjuna. Unquote. A Kshatriya, because of his karma, is cursed to take his next birth as a Shudra. But because he took to saintly life, specifically concentrating his mind always upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he became a pure devotee. Immediately after giving up his body in the fire, he reached the spiritual world, as mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, as a result of devotional service. Devotional service performed by thinking of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is so powerful that although Prashudra was cursed, he avoided the terrible consequences of it becoming a Shudra and instead returned home back to Godhead. As stated in Brahma Samhita 5.54, those who engage in devotional service are unaffected by the results of their material activities. Otherwise, everyone, from the smallest microbe up to the King of Heaven, is subject to the laws of karma. A pure devotee, being always engaged in the service of the Lord, is exempt from these laws. Om Gyanatudamandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshurimavitam Yenatas Vaishiguru. This is a very extreme example of a guru-disciple relationship when a devotee who dedicates his life to the protection of cows accidentally kills a cow while his intent was to protect it from an attacking tiger. For which he was cursed by the family priest Vasishtha Muni to become a Shudra. This is a very harsh and apparently unreasonable response to such an unfortunate situation. But Prashudra accepted it very humbly, very graciously, which indicates that he must have seen it as the arrangement of the Lord to facilitate his advancement in spiritual life. Yesterday we were discussing Prahlad, skipping over all the chapters of how he was tortured and tormented and obstructed by his father. But Prahlad never saw any of that as any obstacle. The first occasion in his life that he saw as an obstacle was when the Lord offered him any benediction he desired. To which he replied, "My Lord, please don't tempt me like this. Born in a dynasty of demons, we have a propensity to be fruitive. But if I seek something in return from you, in exchange for my service, I'm no better than a merchant. I don't want to do business with you, Lord. I want to serve." Yesterday also, usually after class, after the questions and answers period, the really good questions and answers ensue. Maybe people are shy and they don't realize that what is most personal is usually most universal. And devotees relish not so much hearing how Lord Nrisimhadev rips apart Hiranyakashipu in the presence of his loving, gentle, saintly son, which wasn't really easy for Prahlad to take, although he was appreciative that his father was liberated. But devotees cherish the internal dynamic of what's being given outward alignment by the pastime of how the Lord deals with the demons in our own hearts. Now, some people don't like to admit that we struggle with internal demons. But without that honesty, it's not possible to make advancement, because you're not true to where you really are, and you're beginning from some imaginary position from which your progress cannot be really tangible. But sincere, humble devotees acknowledge that all the arrogance of Hiranyakashipu and the other five appearances of Jaya and Vijaya in this material world, who personify the archetypes of lust, anger, greed, pride, illusion, envy, which we all have within our hearts, otherwise we wouldn't be here in the material world, unless, like Srila Prabhupada, we just descended. And these demons are so formidable that no kshatriya, no demigod, no army can subdue or control or conquer them. Only the Lord himself can. And by acknowledging that, yes, we have these demons within our hearts, and with faith that the holy name is invested with all the potencies of the Lord, even more in terms of accessibility then we take shelter. Someone was questioning yesterday friends who don't like to talk about internal demons as if that's beyond our or below our dignity. So how do you impress such persons that the demons are there, however subtle they may be? Demons don't have to have horns and fangs to identify themselves. Any desire to take the central position in any situation, to be the controller or enjoyer, however subtly, means you're competing with Krishna. If he wants to put you in that position, you may accept humbly as devotional service. But to strive to achieve some position, to fulfill your hankering to be the center, the enjoyer, the controller, is competing with Krishna. And isn't this what demons do? And why does anybody compete with Krishna? How could Hiranyakashipu believe that when Lord Nrsingadeva appeared before him, I'll kill him? Is ignorance related to envy? But we do have a certain legitimate ability to control, and that is being revealed here by Prishadra. The Lord has given us one realm to control. He desires that we take charge of that kingdom, and he facilitates and gives us all help, inspiration, and empowerment to do so, if we approach this task humbly, and that is to take charge of your consciousness, which becomes your world. And we have a graphic example here with Prishadra, with all good intent, dedicating his life to protecting Krishna's cows, but due to unfortunate, unavoidable mistake, attacking a tiger in the pitch black of night, cutting off the ear of the tiger, but killing the cow, not even realizing it until the sun rose the next morning, and Vasishtha cursed him. Quite unreasonable. but he took it as the mercy of the Lord. He took shelter of the Lord. He detached himself from all responsibilities that would impede his exclusive dedication to remembrance and taking shelter of the Lord. And then while residing in the forest and seeing the forest fire, accepted the opportunity to go back home, back to Godhead, by entering into it. But although devotees accept everything, insults, injury, harassment, misunderstanding, as the mercy of the Lord, we do not have the right to be careless and insensitive in our dealings with devotees. Yesterday I noticed that while quoting the words of Prahlad Maharaj, praying to Lord Nrsimhadev to not feel attachment to the prison of family life, when Matadi left. So I asked her later, did you take offense at that? And she said, no, it's just a coincidence that she had to leave at that time. But coincidence is God's means of remaining anonymous. And I was thinking, there was some significance to that. Although, quoting the words of Prahlad Maharaj, you have to see everything in context. Sambandha means to understand your proper relationship with the environment, which includes the circumstances. In ISKCON, we don't have a great history of sweet and loving relationships. And as last time we were discussing in the previous verses about Sudyumna, who was born a girl, and her father didn't like that, so he had Vasishtha turn him into a boy. And the father liked that, but unknowingly he entered into the forest of Lord Shiva, where he embarrassed Parvati. So Lord Shiva turned him back into a Mataji, which the citizens didn't like, because Matajis are not as predictable as men, because they're more oriented towards feelings, which are not as predictable as the weather, whereas men are more oriented towards reason. And which is better? Well, Srila Prabhupada said that religion without philosophy is sentiment. Philosophy without religion is mental speculation. Either one, potentially fanatical, divorced from the other. But what is important? The relationship. So, and then Sujumna got the blessing to be a man 1 month and a woman the next, which just really didn't satisfy anyone. But the perfection of that arrangement is he took vanaprastha and entered the forest and took shelter of Krishna. So we're not in charge of the circumstances in our lives. But Krishna does want us to take charge of our responses. Conditioned means that when an action presents itself, you react. And therefore, if someone praises you, you become elated. If someone insults you, you become insulted. These are not responses, these are reactions. And then the reaction becomes an action to trigger other reactions, and the karma is perpetuated by this conditioned nature. We have the God-given free will to choose our response. And that necessitates we drive a wedge to create a little space between the action and reaction and choose a response, what would be pleasing to the Vaishnavas, approved by Guru, and acceptable to Krishna. Yesterday we were discussing Haridas Thakur, who being beaten so viciously by all the Muslim executioners, not as a regular execution, but as a public disgrace to humiliate him in his death. But all he's doing is praying for the welfare of those who were torturing him. And seeing this, everyone was concluding he must be Prahlad Maharaj. Although he's not, he's Brahma. But the spirit of Prahlad had entered his consciousness. Because when Brahma prayed to take such a humble birth, that he would never again fall prey to pride, as inaugurated the Brahma Vimohan Lila and Lord Gauranga. Because Brahma, in his prayers to Krishna, after the Brahma Vimohan Lila, did not get any response at all from the Lord. As Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur tells us, Krishna was looking at Brahma down there in the dust of Braj Bhumi, thinking, who is this four-headed person? And where did he come from? And what is he talking about? I don't understand any of this. I just want to find my calves and my friends. And the prayers of Brahma, Tathena Tecumseh Sumikshiman, oh, a great inspiration for devotees for all eternity. But Krishna totally disregarded everything. And Brahma, returning to his abode, totally dejected, began to reflect. Krishna will come again in a more munificent form. I must approach him. He'll appear in Navadvip. So he descended there. And the story was told as an answer to Jiva Goswami's question, where did the name Antardvip come from? Within Navadvip, within Mayapur, the abode of mercy. Antar means secret or heart. And Lord Nityananda explained, then Brahma came down to Antardvip, which is the island in the central stamen of the lotus, Navadvip Dham, which correlates to Atmanivedana, surrender of the soul, surrender of the heart. That's where the Lord appears. You know, the Dham is that synergy of loving relationships, and devotees become so attached to their respective Dham that though they may leave and visit devotees in another Dham, they always come back. And even though Krishna may leave the Dhamvasis stay in the Dham, because Krishna is present in that synergy of loving relationships from past, present, and future. That dynamic which nurtures and corresponds to our own nature of love. So Brahma came to Antardvip, Mayapur, performing tapasya until Lord Gauranga appeared before him, his arms raised in the air, swaying gently with the grace of Braj Bhakti, and looking down upon Brahma with great affection, asking, why have you come? And he responded, my Lord, I'm a lowly, worthless, wretched fool who's controlled by pride, and therefore I could not understand your Braj Leela. But I know that you'll return to make that Braj Leela more accessible through a powerful process of devotional service. But that requires great humility. Please arrange a birth for me that I will never again fall prey to my wicked mind. The first 100 trillion years of my life has been wasted, which brings him to the point of a midlife crisis. How will the next 100 trillion years go? Please be merciful. And the Lord said, I will arrange for you to take birth in a Yavana family, which is similar to the curse issued here by Vasishtha. Worse than a Shudra family, which is exalted being in the Varnashram Dharma, but Lord Ranga said, you will take birth in the Avana family, which means he would be an outcast to the Hindus, but he would be an outcast to the Avanas because he is always chanting Hare Krishna. No shelter anywhere in this world. But he endeared himself so deeply to the hearts of the Vaishnavas that Lord Gauranga proclaimed to him at the Mahaprakash, Haridas, look at me. Your body is more pure than mine. Your status, your position, I desire to achieve. Krishna is the shelter of those who are materially exhausted. So he, Lord Gauranga, said, as Haridas Thakur, you will participate and enrich my pastimes, and as you depart from this world, your deepest aspiration will be fulfilled in seeing me face to face. And I don't know of any other devotee for whom Lord Gauranga personally begged the alms for the funeral ceremony, as well as dancing with him in his lap, and proclaiming to be the sea which bathed his body to be thereon a holy place of pilgrimage. So we don't have control of what comes into our lives. And if you want to be in control, you're competing with Krishna. But he has given you the ability, and he wants to give you the blessings and empowerment to facilitate your free will to make the right choices. Character is just the outcome of the choices that we make throughout life. We can't choose our circumstances, but we can choose our response, our attitude, and that is given by Lord Brahma. Tathai Nadakamsa Samikshimano. Whatever comes. And Lord Gauranga, in that whole chapter, Lord Gauranga dancing with Gopi, is revealing to us, do not disrespect the Lord's energies. Even his material nature has a transcendent dimension. If you treat her with respect and pray to her for bhakti, she'll make it firm. But if you look at her as someone to exploit, enjoy and control, then she reveals her other aspect of throwing and covering. And if you accept that with gratitude, she'll still reciprocate with you as a mother. But that's Durga, the shadow of Srimati. So, and we have to be very selective in our words. You know, children used to taunt each other with a sing-song, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Nothing is further than the truth. And amongst words, those are family members, and ISKCON is a family. It's supposed to be. And no enemy can pierce you so deeply or hurt you so sharply as loved ones. Because to family members and loved ones, you open your heart, you reveal your mind, you share your aspirations, you serve together in camaraderie, and you bond. If they violate the conditions of that relationship, it can devastate you more than any weapons or enemies could ever come close to. So So there's, you know, the active violating of principles. There's also the passive, but you neglect or disregarding others. You know, when city people come to the farm communities and manage the ISKCON farms like city temples, and they exalt the cow on some high pedestal and worship her, and we preach, the cow is glorious because she solves all our economic problems. But then we beg to our donors, we have cows. You must donate because we have to take care of these cows, and it's very costly. What kind of message does that convey to the donors, the devotees, and the cows themselves? So Krishna plays a flute because he's a cowherd boy. Balaram carries a plow because he's the patron of the ox, the father image. And for a teamster, a plowboy, that's me, you know that although an ox is not an especially intellectual creature, they are very understanding of whether you appreciate what Krishna has designed them to give. They give their service. They plow the fields. And what is that activity? What is so sacramental about the plow that Baladev always holds it? That's how you turn over that old and useless growth. You open the furrow where you plant the seed. It's sacramental. Why does Sita Devi? And as Srila Prabhupada told the story of Srimati Radharani's appearance, it was in the furrow, not the usual Gaudiya Vaishnava version. Interesting that he chose that version. Because Srila Prabhupada, although he called himself a Calcutta boy, was more deeply aware of the dynamics of village life and agriculture than any farmer I've ever known. Now you can say he got that from Gandhi, which historically has some merit, but it was deeper than that. It's the culture of Braj, the culture of loving relationships. And on a farm, you don't look at that ox as, why didn't he turn out to be a cow? Cows give, what do oxen give? Now Jatayu knows that they give manure, which is more valuable than the milk. But they give their life to serving the family as a father figure. And in agriculture, of course, if you have tractors around, you look at the ox as a burden, because my instant control and gratification will be fulfilled by the tractor, but the ox is going to demand of me a relationship. And that's not always convenient, but neither is going back to Godhead. I've heard people say that, you know, oxen, that's a hassle. So is going back to Godhead. So they're not especially a bright animal, but they know what is your attitude. If you put the ox out there in the field and say that keeping him for life, protecting him from the slaughterhouse, qualifies as cow protection, it falls short of Srila Prabhupada's definition. That the cow, and that includes the ox, be jolly. What makes them jolly? When they know that their gifts are being accepted and appreciated by society. And you're looking upon them with appreciation. And in that dynamic of loving exchange, Krishna becomes a reality in your life, manifest in your relationships, not just with your God brothers who are always talking about Krishna, but in everything that is conveying to us a message from Krishna and asking, what is your response? Krishna playing as a child in the dust of Braj Bhumi. asking, what is your response? As the charioteer of Arjuna in the midst of armies in violent warfare, looking upon all, what is your response? When the Jadus were killed in fratricidal violence, and it seemed like Krishna was pierced by a hunter's arrow and died like an ordinary man, but he's looking upon us, what is your response? My dear created parts and parcels, invested with my love, where is your response? Krishna is the dearmost friend of every living entity. Sankirtan means all-inclusive. Use everything in the service of the Lord. And that's where farm communities are especially blessed. Just because a calf turned out to be a bull instead of a cow, it doesn't mean he's bereft of an opportunity of a lifelong service. Unless he's replaced by a tractor, but we won't get into that. And, you know, for someone who throughout life has, you know, interacted with animals in the forest and draft animals on the farm, did you ever meet a peacock? Ever try to interact with a peacock? They're in a totally different world than any bird or beast of this world. And I always used to wonder, you know, they come and, at least I had this one, he'd come and look at Adi Shyam, and he'd look at all these different ways. I think, what is he thinking? And it took years for that relationship to blossom into any kind of understanding as what is on the mind of a peacock, because they don't communicate the way that normal birds and beasts do. But Krishna speaks the language of all of them. So, regarding the upsurge of feelings and emotions rising to crest with the appearance of Krishna and Balaram, we should understand or consider how they interact with their environment. When the peacocks hear thunder rumbling from the clouds, it affects them very much like the flute of Shyamasundar, and they begin to sing and dance. And when they hear Krishna's flute song, their hearts are so enraptured that their hearts begin to sing, and they fan out their tails, and they raise their feathers, and they vibrate their feathers, and they arch their neck, and they fill the sky with their own sound, which as it reverberates off the cliffs of Govardhan Hill, rising in their crescendo, which inspires them to dance. And when the peacocks all unite, and then the peahens come in and they do their thing, and they're all dancing together so harmoniously, so beautifully, that Krishna is inspired to dance into their midst and dance with the peacocks. And then Krishna, he arches his neck and he throws back his head and he protrudes his chest and he pulls out the tail of his dhoti and extends it behind him like the tail of a peacock. And then the peacocks become very excited. They begin to jump in the air and flap their wings, and their heads bob up and down, and they start rotating this way and that way in different patterns. And Krishna, who knows the language of the peacocks, hears them say, "Dear Lord, please play and dance with us so that we, by our dancing, can enrich and participate in your Leela." And then Krishna glances upon the peacocks with an affection so tender that it just makes them very humbly bow down under its gentle weight. And then as the peacocks inspire Krishna to dance, and he inspires them to dance, and they teach him to dance, and he teaches them how to dance, and Krishna's flute is resonating the appropriate raga to inspire this dance, and Krishna closes his eyes and becomes so absorbed that the flute in his hand begins to sing of its own volition. And Krishna looked at that, he never noticed before. Usually, the flute conveys the love of Krishna's heart, which by the touch of his lips is broadcast through the atmosphere. But now he's holding it out in his hand as his arms are outstretched like peacock wings, and the flute is still playing a spontaneous song of its own. And the flute takes the lead in the kirtan, and even in Braj, where wonders abound, this was something not to be missed. So on the high cliffs of Govardhan Hill, the birds and the deer and the rabbits and the snakes all started crowding over the edge of the cliffs, and material nature had to adjust everything so they didn't just all topple over. And even those who were situated at a long distance by the arrangement of Yoga Maya were seeing so clearly as if they had ringside seats as Krishna danced with the peacocks. And it was the most ecstatic scene of artistic wonder. And Krishna, in the midst of the peacocks, was like a crescent jewel surrounded by all these beautiful, brilliant gems, but it was not static. It was moving and expanding and evolving into the most beautiful patterns, which were visualizations of the mellows that were being extracted from Krishna's heart by this sweet exchange with his peacocks. And gradually, the scene became so enrapturing that everyone was just stunned in wonder. And as morning went into noon, and days turned into weeks, turned into months, and years and decades, and days and nights of Brahma, time had to expand to incorporate this lila. And Krishna, with his eyes closed, was the only one who continued to dance according to the song of his flute. And Baladeva is wondering, is Krishna dancing according to the song of the flute, or is the song of the flute responding to Krishna's dance? And Krishna and Baladeva is trying to evaluate, you know, who's leading and who's following. And his conclusion was, it's a match. It's a tie. It's a synergy. It's a relationship. Each was inspiring the other. And gradually, Krishna's turban was so askew, and his decorations were so in such disarray, and his garland was just scattered all over the meadow. Still, he couldn't stop dancing. And this scene was expanding into eternity. But Baladev, who's very crucial to Krishna's lila, concluded that it's time to end, but how to stop Krishna's dancing? So he just very gently embraced Krishna, so tenderly that Krishna's eyes opened and looked into the loving, tender face of his big brother, But the wonderful thing is, even though Krishna was looking into Baladev's eyes, every single peacock, deer, bird, snake, and rabbit, as well as the cowherd boys, was thinking that Krishna is looking at me so tenderly. He's reciprocating with me so intimately. And even though everybody else here is so much better than me, Krishna sees me as special. And this is not reason to be proud. It's a stimulus to be all the more humble, that all greatness is due to Krishna. So when the stunned peacocks, who were immobilized by the superiority of Krishna's peacock dance, kind of came back to life, the king of the peacocks approached Krishna, and with tears flowing from his eyes, fell down at Krishna's lotus feet and told him that, "My dear Lord, in exchange for you teaching us how to dance like peacocks, we are so indebted to you. But what can we offer you as a token of our gratitude? We live in the forest and we eat flowers, which gets us in trouble with the temple commander." That's my commentary. On behalf of the peacocks. So, but if we fail to give you something in exchange for your love, we'll be guilty of ingratitude and we'll lose the reputation of our race. So I'm going to offer you the best opulence in our kingdom, which is our tail feathers. And then he turned his tail towards Krishna and dropped a bunch of feathers, and Krishna picked them up and placed them in his turban, like his most favorite crown. And he held the others in his hand because he didn't want to ever be without them. And even when Krishna returned from Dwarka to Braj, after long separation, and he just cast aside his royal robes and his celestial jewelry and his golden crown, and he put on his gopa vesh, but he was looking all around, something is missing. And the cowherd boys understood. They quickly gathered some peacock feathers and gave them to Krishna. And this is, you know, after he'd been reigning in Dwarka as Dwarkadish for so long. But he was disoriented without those peacock feathers in his hair. And then he was able to resume his mellows with the Brajavasis. But a plow is also, just to show how Srila Prabhupada is the perfect representative of Baladev. The old-time theologians of the West considered that another form of the plow is the pen. And a blank piece of paper is like a fallow field. The lines on the paper made by the pen become the furrows, and the words become the seed. Because Srila Prabhupada's words are not like words of this world. They're sacraments, which are not mere symbols to convey something else, an arbitrary designation for reality beyond themselves. But sacramental word means they contain and they convey and they crystallize the reality they denote. So Srila Prabhupada's books, Windows to the Spiritual Sky, reveal to us what kind of response to choose, whether life deals you what you want or what you hate. Krishna is impartial. He gives everyone what is good for them because he loves us. Knowing this, realizing it, and practicing it, we must choose a humble and loving response. And oftentimes when somebody approaches you with harsh words, it's some kind of test from Krishna, from an insecure soul who has been so traumatized by life that they don't know how to interact except harshly. And a loving response can oftentimes awaken the soul to hope that we can find love even in this world if we interact in the manner that Krishna's servants should. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments? Yes, I'm finishing the book. Now, I would also like to add before you continue, not to interrupt you, but before I forget, that nothing is so obvious as the things we try to hide. Please continue.
Thank you. Give me time to write that down. So it seems like honesty is less something we are trained in and more a manifestation of purity of heart, because it also seems like the immediate effect of honesty is embarrassment or humility, but the long-range effect for a spiritual aspirant is realization and being more properly situated, as opposed to a lie. It may have some immediate or apparent immediate benefit, but long-term it's devastating. So there's that real kind of dichotomy that we're kind of in as an individual and as a society, in terms of fostering in the heart honesty.
Srila Rupa Goswami has given six aspects of loving exchange, beginning with revealing the mind in confidence. And this can be quite intimidating when we're so conditioned to being rejected and labeled and branded for revealing our hearts. And therefore, the other part of the exchange, receiving worthy instructions accordingly, would direct and guide who we choose to reveal our hearts to. Because the quality for revealing your heart is confidence. And the criterion for being the recipient of someone's gesture of love and revealing their heart to you is confidence. Nothing is so devastating as someone revealing their heart in confidence and then finding it was broadcast publicly. Anyway, the magic we find when you reveal your heart in confidence, and that is honored in confidence, is that you're not rejected. You're appreciated for your honesty and your humility. And you usually find, there again, that what is most personal is usually most universal. But I would say that the deepest dynamic in revealing the heart in confidence, which is another component of honesty, is that what you're trying to resolve in your head and just never affects any tangible change in your life descends into your heart, where tangible change originates by that element of revealing the heart. Because it's going from a theoretical exercise in your mind where you're going before Krishna or Srila Prabhupada and confessing, I did this and please guide me. But it's really all in your mind. Because there's no other living person. I mean, Srila Prabhupada's living in his words and his instructions, but when it's all in your mind, he's not there. When you confess before a living person with all the fears that he's going to reject me, he's going to label me, he's going to brand me, which hopefully wouldn't be the case amongst good Vaishnavas, but rather he appreciates that I'm revealing where I am, so that he can reach to that level and touch my soul, then you find a dynamic shift where your aspirations actually become realized, because it has entered into the realm of relationship, which is reality. We're all related. And as the analogy I often use, the Ark of the Covenant, which is like a big trunk, on top of which were two angels with outstretched wings, forming the Ark. And the Word of God to the Hebrews was the Ten Commandments, enshrined in that Ark, between the outstretched wings of the angels, which means that truth resides in relationships. Otherwise, it's all theoretical. It's all in your head. It's not a matter of the heart. And when it becomes a matter of the heart, it becomes real. And then tangible progress in life can ensue. Thank you. Anything else? Yes.
In 12-step program,
you're only as sick as your secret.
Mm.
And so they see a problem, it exists in darkness, it's like a disease, and then when it's revealed, it comes to the light, and the light is what can cure it.
And where do rakshasas and demons become powerful? In darkness. And when the light shines in, they lose their power, and the elements of goodness take prominence.
Well, I have the mic. Can I ask a question? About yesterday, a comment, your answer to a question. When Harinam Chintamani was asking about our own faults and our difficulty dealing with our own faults, and you gave your answer how these, similar to what we're saying here, these faults in a sense are gifts from which we can grow. And then Prana Govinda gave the answer that when we get sadhusanga and we become humble, then naturally forgiveness will be there. And it seems those are two opposite ends in a sense, and there's this vast area in the middle. So I was wondering if you could speak about the idea that automatically everything comes from bhakti. Well, if I just get to this platform, then all the other problems will be solved, or all the good qualities will develop. And then the other side, in which we're not on that platform and we have to do something to deal with it or make some effort beyond just the automatic process. So kind of the balance or the understanding of the dynamics between the two sides of the solution.
A corresponding theme in that question, if it's the same question, it was definitely the theme in a related question, is why is forgiveness? The three components of forgiveness: I am forgiven, I forgive others, and I forgive myself. Forgiving of oneself is most difficult. Well, you know, we often have higher expectations of ourselves than what we're capable of achieving. But then you have to question, shouldn't I have such high aspirations? because Srila Prabhupada gave us very high expectations. But the crucial criterion is whether you think you can achieve that standard by your own ability. If you do, you're always going to fall short of your expectations, and you're always going to have trouble with forgiveness. Whereas if you realize that whatever I can be is only a gift, and it's only Krishna and Gurudev working through me that can be of any good to anyone, then you can achieve things even beyond your realization, because you're a puppet. You're a servant. And when you give all credit and all glory to Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga, taking none upon yourself, you can be an instrument. So, sadhu sangha infuses us with the ability to be instruments of grace. That might not correspond to our self-image of how we think or want to serve. Does that touch upon your question? Can you repeat your question again?
It's the apparent dichotomy between making an effort to achieve something and that everything will be achieved as a byproduct of bhakti. And the dichotomy being, well, we're not on that level of bhakti in which everything is achieved. So
the problem that I've observed that comes in that dichotomy is we think, well, just take shelter devotional service, and the scripture tells us that all the good qualities of the demigods appear in the devotee. So we just immerse ourselves in service. But then we wonder, why doesn't that work? Well, service requires protocol. You know, we can say, well, I'm just a servant. Well, that's actually a very high standard to come up to. The servant of Krishna requires very high credentials. Those credentials sum it all up in one thing that Srila Prabhupada said when questioned, how can we recognize your devotee? He's a gentleman or a lady. So we can't just act any way we want and immerse ourselves in service and say all the good qualities have either already manifest, whether you see it or not, or they're coming. You have to practice those qualities. And then the argument is usually, I feel like a hypocrite. I'm really a demon, but I'm acting, you know. We're like Putanas, you know. We come to Krishna with a desire other than pure devotional service, and Putana put on such a nice sari and dressed so beautifully and acted so graciously that everyone, including Mother Jashoda, fell for it and just put Krishna right into her arms. So isn't this what sadhana bhakti is? We come to Krishna, our intents are not pure, we put on dhotis and saris and tilak and chant Hare Krishna and approach Krishna. But are we really approaching Krishna? We shouldn't be thinking that we're approaching Krishna. We should be thinking, I'm assisting Srila Prabhupada in serving Krishna. And then you're safe. But even being around Srila Prabhupada, he demanded a certain type of behavior and etiquette. And even though, you know, you're putting on a little bit of an act, it's not for the sake of deceiving. And therefore, it does not qualify as duplicity. And therefore the excuse that I feel duplicitous does not hold. Because by intelligence you understand this is how I should act. And this is the way the soul does act. And I am soul, but I'm in a conditioned body that has this lower nature. It's not that I have to act according to that lower nature to be genuine.
You put it in an act. You don't feel it. It's not totally integrated with your yet, but actually it is on a deeper level. And you're practicing what is true with the faith that it'll become real and integrated as your practice becomes perfect. So it's not that we just, you know, continue acting roughly and crudely, citing the verse that all the good qualities of the demigods appear in the body of a devotee. And I'm a devotee because I wear a devotee and tilak. We're practicing devotees. That means we also have to practice the behavior and the etiquette and the culture. Otherwise we can't claim that we're devotees. We don't claim we're devotees anyway. We're aspiring. We're practicing. We're servants of the servants with the hope to someday become devotees by practice. But the practice is not only in serving, but it is the behavior and the etiquette and the culture that is worthy of a servant of Krishna. It's a very high standard. And even though we haven't realized it, we practice it. And then we're given some credit. Thank you. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.